So, good evening, everybody. We worked hard in our last session and dug as deeply as we could manage. It will be fun for you to reflect on the fact that after a summary that I offered, which took about 7 minutes, the whole rest of the time was spent on these words. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercy of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. So that's what we commented on. We want to move on from there. But let me summarize the hour that we spent on just those words. I drew your attention, first of all, to the word therefore, and suggested that we give it its full weight, not just as connected with several previous verses, but as the whole letter standing behind it and being pulled into this deeply condensed sentence that St. Paul is uttering. Therefore, I appeal. We spoke about the Greek word translated here as I appeal, parakaleo, from which the title for the Holy Spirit comes. Paraclete, parakaleo, the advocate, the one who is not a soft appeal here. It's an urgent, enormous appeal. It's a very strong verb that Paul uses. Therefore, I appeal, brothers and sisters. I said that he's not addressing himself primarily to an individual reader or hearer, but he's addressing himself to the whole Roman community, whom he wants to consider, brothers and sisters, wants them to consider that among themselves. And we know from the context of what has preceded it, this title applies equally to Jew and Gentile in the community. So, therefore, I appeal to you, brothers, by the mercies of God. Very strong statement that his appeal is rooted not in some bright idea that he'd like to convince you of, but it's rooted in the mercies of God, which the whole previous part of the letter have treated. In the specific terms of this letter, the mercies of God that he has written whole chapters are on God's response to the sin of the Gentiles and to the Jewish inability to keep the law, the merciful response of the justification that is worked through Christ's death on the cross, the mercy that is shown in God's freeing us from the slavery of sin to live in the Spirit, the mercies that God shows in the enigma of Jewish disbelief, which opens the door to us Gentile believers. All this Paul calls the mercies of God, and on the basis of it, he makes this huge appeal. And the appeal is this. It is nothing less than what I called a new kind of sacrifice, a new kind of worship, a new cult. Paul uses a surprising set of words in what follows. I appeal to you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice. We were surprised to see the word sacrifice as what Paul is concerned with. And sacrifice has a lot of baggage in the ancient world. Sacrifice would immediately imply a religious ritual, and a religious ritual in which animals are slain or some precious food poured out on the ground. And that's called worship in the ancient world. Paul, on the basis of everything he has developed in the letter, is saying to the Roman community, there's a new kind of worship, and the new kind of worship is in your bodies presented as a living sacrifice. We paused a long time on the verb that he uses there, presenting your bodies as a living sacrifice. And though he only uses the verb there once, he used it five times in dramatic language in chapter 6. So we appeal to the meaning in chapter 6 for the force of its meaning now in chapter 12. And we saw that in chapter 6, Paul was using that verb as he concluded the effects of baptism in the believer. The effects of baptism are to have plunged believers into the death of Christ, which effectively puts sin to death in them and causes the possibility of living a new life. And therefore, he's already using that big therefore in chapter 6. Therefore, he says, what do you do if you're dead to sin and living a new life? Therefore, he says, present your bodies. He begins by saying, let sin not reign in your mortal bodies, but give the members of your body, present the members of your body, there's the word present we want to see, to God, to become slaves of righteousness. Your bodies had been presented to become slaves of disobedience, slaves of sin, slaves of death. Now present them to righteousness and to become slaves of God. That was in chapter 6, and we use that to come back to chapter 12 and see that Paul is summarizing the idea developed at length there by saying again, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. After that, we paused to notice for sure what would have been very striking to the original audience and what can become striking for us if we think about it, is to see the word living beside the word sacrifice. That would have shocked the ancient world. Sacrifice is where something is killed. Instead, nothing's killed here. There's a living sacrifice, and the living sacrifice is, in fact, our lives. A living sacrifice. That's as far as we got. Let's go on now to what follows from that. Or maybe just let me summarize a little bit more, because that's where I got into the controversy about sacrifice. Living sacrifice, that's a good one. It's in contrast to bodies of animals slain. But it's also very important that we see Paul is moving in a striking way with the word sacrifice for what Christ himself did for us on the cross. And I began to answer a group of scholars who were saying that there would really not be any connection between Christ's sacrifice on the cross and what Paul is urging Christians here. These scholars would say that it's two different uses of the word sacrifice. And on first impact, I found that hard to believe or think as correct. And so I began to dig around and shared with you some of the thoughts that led me to realize that throughout Paul's writings, he is constantly managing the paradox of death and life moving together in the Christian. And Paul, I think, is unquestionably aware that the sacrifice of Christ is extended into the life of the Christian. I use some very key texts for that. There would certainly be more, but we looked at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 11 and 12. For while we live, we are always being given up to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus may be manifested in our mortal bodies. So there is death and life working very strongly there, and we see that Paul is talking about his own life as a Christian. While we live, we are always being given to death for Jesus' sake. We can call that sacrifice. But what does that result in? It results in the life of Jesus manifest in our mortal flesh. And the life of Jesus alive after his sacrifice, That's in the Christian. You see my puzzlement at saying, how can you say there's no relationship between the sacrifice of Christ and the sacrifice of the Christian? Another text I presented you with to argue against that position is Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And I said on the heels of that verse that if Christians are able to offer their bodies as a sacrifice, this can only mean that they have in some way been crucified with Christ. So the sacrifice is a crucifixion with Christ, which causes Christ to live in me in a way that's who I am, Christ alive in me, and that I'm living my life as a sacrifice in the same way that he lived his life as a sacrifice. And to give some concrete sense of what does that mean to live my life as a sacrifice, we looked at Colossians 1:24, what is at first a strange verse, but one which makes perfect sense in the line of what I'm saying. In my own flesh, Paul says, I complete what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ for the sake of his body, the church. This is the sacrifice that Christians are able to offer, that of a holy life lived in this way. Now we can go on to the fuller phrase that we see after the expression living sacrifice. There are several more words that we need to pause on. A living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, your spiritual worship. Holy and acceptable. I'm not going to comment too much at length on that, except for to ask you to note that those are words that surround the language of sacrifice. A sacrifice has to be made holy. Literally, the word holy from the Hebrew tradition means set apart, and acceptable, that there's a plea to the gods in any sacrifice offered that the sacrifice be acceptable. And what St. Paul is saying here then is he's continuing to pile up the language of the cult for this new application of the words. So not only a living sacrifice, but one, it's Christ who makes the sacrifice living. It also will be Christ who makes the sacrifice holy and acceptable. But where I want to do some work is on this last phrase, your spiritual worship. It's translated in the text I gave you from the RSV, which is your spiritual worship. I'd like to translate really a lot more closely. I just want to take the which is out, which maybe doesn't seem too important to you, but in some ways it helps us to feel that Paul has placed this phrase, living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, your spiritual worship. That's the word order in the Greek. It doesn't say which is your spiritual worship. So spiritual worship is another name for the living sacrifice, holy and acceptable. In a sense, it's a subtlety, but it's an important one. Grammatically, if you can remember grammar classes, this word is an apposition. That means it stands right beside the other one and says the same thing. And the reason you say the same thing, it doesn't say the same thing. Otherwise, you'd say the same thing or stop. But you're saying those things are exactly the same. So, your spiritual worship, that's the phrase that we need to speak about now. And we need to say right at the outset that this common translation of the phrase in virtually all the English translations, spiritual worship, is inadequate. But it's very difficult to convey in other languages what is suggested by the Greek here. I've written the phrase on the board in Greek. That's Greek there. And that's the way we transliterate Greek. The expression is logike latreia. And where we want to begin to pause on something is to look at the word logike, which is the Greek word logos, which is the Greek word that it translates as, I got to stay by the microphone, you can see it. It's the Greek word that translates as reason or as word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Word was God. But Paul and John, from whom that prologue comes, are not in the same theological vocabulary universe, but logos is a Greek word, and it's in their language. Every language has its genius words, and logos is certainly one of the genius words of the Greek language. It's a word full of nuances, and it's hard to translate it with a single word in English. I've said what its main sense is, reason, word, but in a very deep sense, meaning connection, like you have by reasoning, meaning word, like you have, that's a connection too. Words refer to something. And a real logos refers to something in an adequate way, such that if you have the word, you have the reality. So this is a huge title for Christ, but we're not going to get stray off on that because he's not using it as a title for Christ here. Logos coheres with reality. And this is a profound dimension of Greek philosophy and of the Greek religious spirit. That things be logikos. That's the adjective. Okay? We would say that things be, it doesn't come across if I say that things be rational. But that says some of it. But rational sounds just brainy to us. That things be wordy. Well, that doesn't sound good at all. But that if we could find, I don't want to say this, because we're doing our theology in English, I want to use the word logical as an adjective that, not what it means in contemporary English, but I want to use the word logical as so that you hear its connection with logos. So it's logical worship, but that won't work because logical worship sounds too brainy to us also. So the best I can come up with is a paraphrase that would be worship characterized by logos. And I don't object to saying spiritual worship in translations, except that you can say spiritual worship in Greek with another word. There's a word, very clear word, pneumatikos, to say spiritual worship. And Paul doesn't use that word. He uses instead a word that says, this is worship characterized by logos. One of the reasons we have to pause and understand this here is in part because of the influence that Paul's expression had hereafter. The reason this phrase, which occurs nowhere else in Paul, is one of the reasons why there is a group of scholars. Remember, I said Paul doesn't use this language anywhere else, so the idea can't be from Paul. And I objected to that, saying, you know, why in the world could Paul not have a new idea? But in fact, we need to know that the phrase logike latreria exists in the philosophical world of the Greeks. And so it's out there in general. We'll come to that later in what it meant in general. But I want to just pause here and stay inside Paul's text, tell you what I think it means there, even if you didn't know that it's in the current philosophical jargon in Paul's world. Okay? So, all that to say, let's go back to the phrase. We can look at our text. Present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, worship, characterized by logos. So what is the worship characterized by logos? The way you live is worship characterized by logos. But what more precisely would that mean? What does it mean right here in this letter from Paul, placing it, as I'm drawing your attention to, in the grammatical position of a strongly qualifying apposition to living sacrifice? Paul's concern here in using this kind of language becomes more clear if we notice the connection again with chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. When we were first moving through that, I called those verses Paul's description of the Gentile predicament. You can check those verses out on your own with a little study, but let me summarize for you what St. Paul says in chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. Gentiles are mired in sin, he says, because though they could have known God through the things he had made, instead they have exchanged the glory of the immortal God for a whole range of lies and were delivered up to disgraceful passions. That's me summarizing about 10 verses, but the key verses are chapter 1, some of you are taking notes, so here they are, verses 20, 23, and 26. The issue of you could have known God, but instead you have exchanged the glory of the immortal God and been given over to disgraceful passions. Just to see where we're going to go with this, I'm going to say one of the things that certainly is not is logikos. There's no logos in that. If you had logos, you could look at the creation and you would see God. Logos would help you to do it. Instead, you're alogos. You are out of your mind. That's what he's saying. And as a result of that, you have been given over to disgraceful passions. That's why you act. That's why you are mired in sin. So what is at issue here, among other things, with Paul's description of the Gentile predicament, is correct worship. The Gentiles were idolaters. And in verse 23, he says what they did was they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. What's he talking about here? He's talking about forms of primitive religion where you see these animals or human images worshipped in various ways, either used live, the sacred bird, the sacred snake, a man or a woman posing in various, sexually hyped up and super thing, becoming gods. It's wrong worship, but it certainly happens. The Gentile world is full of it in Paul's time. Our world is full of it still. No one dare say so, but, it's there. So now, in Romans 12:1, Paul is proposing a very different kind of worship than the images resembling birds, animals, or reptiles. He is proposing, in its stead, logike latreria, logos, worship characterized by logos. In the first chapter of Romans, Paul says that God punished the false worship of the Gentiles by, quote, giving them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity and to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. That's Romans 1:24, and the point is vividly developed in verses 24 to 32. I'm not going to read that. The list there is difficult to read in public. It really is. You can read it for yourself. But it's a very frank description of how serious the problem has become because of false worship. That's the point. I want you to hold on to the word false worship. And because of false worship, here's the core of where the problem is showing up. Lusts in their heart and dishonoring their bodies among themselves. If we hear that, and then we hear chapter 12, we see why he's saying to present your bodies in a different way, which will be a different worship than what these people who are out of their minds are doing. So that is why Paul in Romans 12:1 calls for bodies, our bodies, to be offered in sacrifice in obedience to the divine will. It's an obedience that would be true worship of the Creator who is blessed forever. That's what Paul says in the middle of his tirade. They should have been able to look at the creation and get it right. They didn't. But now we can get it right, and that would be logos characterizing our worship. Midway between the irrational worship described in Romans chapter 1 and the worship imbued with logos in Romans chapter 12, we've already seen in Romans chapter 6 what makes such worship in the Logos possible. What makes it possible? Baptism into the death of Christ Jesus. So, in fact, we have a very neat chapter 1, chapter 6, chapter 12. Paul didn't put those chapters and verses there. But they count out beginning, middle, and that end. And it's a very nice preoccupation, if you will, with worship at each of those key points. That's what I want you to see. And we could summarize it the way Paul does in Romans 6, verses 11 to 13, where he says, "You must consider yourselves dead to sin and alive to God in Christ Jesus. Let not sin, therefore, reign in your mortal bodies." I want to add, like in chapter 1 I described, okay? Let not sin reign in your mortal bodies, because that's what was happening, and that is the Gentile predicament. Let not sin reign in your mortal bodies to make them obey your passions. But right here in chapter 6 he says, but present yourselves in your body to God, which, like I'm going to say again at chapter 12, and like the retreat's going to be on, he says. So that's the link between those. So now, the problem with worship and the passions that form part of the Gentile predicament, we see, is a problem of rightly understanding God and rightly understanding God's creation. These people who should have known better became, I'm going to quote again, this is verse 20, 22, 28, all these ideas are condensed into the phrase, became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. This is chapter 1 still, huh? So all of these are the phrases that the word logikos is going to be opposed to. So what is logikos not? Futile in your thinking, senseless minds darkened. Logikos would be clear thinking and bright minds. Okay? Note that the mind, though, is involved here. And what's striking about it, bodies are being offered, but it's logikos. So it's mind and body coming together here in a very lovely kind of way. Still in chapter 1, God gave them up to a base mind, a mind unable to judge. A base mind in Greek, adokimon. And the reason I cite it in Greek, adokimon, means unsound, unable to judge. But I'm getting a little ahead of the game here. But when we get to verse 2, which will be tomorrow, maybe, he speaks about the renewal of your mind that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and what is acceptable and perfect. There's the word dokimos in its positive sense. So we've got a base mind, futile in its thinking, a mind unable to judge rightly. But now in Romans 12 verse 1, Paul proposes instead a worship that is imbued, I want to put it this way, another way to help you understand logikos, a worship that is imbued with mind's best quality. This logos is beautiful. Logos is the best of a human being. Logos is what is the mind that God gave us, so that we could live in the world and make connections. Connections like, I see the beautiful world and my logos lets me know there's God. I see my heart and the logos lets me know what is good and what is evil, and my mind can judge. That's logos at work. And instead, the Gentile predicament is it's without logos. And I'm not talking like Paul is using a Greek word, but he's not talking about the Greeks who wouldn't give too much of a hoot about having their bodies come along. If they could get out of the body, they'd be out of here and they'd be pure logos. And that's what the word means. And I don't want to go there yet, but I have to kind of. I said that the phrase logike latreria is out there in the Greek world. What it means out there in the Greek world is pure, mystical, spiritual worship. Your body ain't there. So that Paul puts logike latreria in opposition with body presented to God. That's huge. And it's a revolution, a religious revolution. It's new worship. But I'll come back to that. We're just piling up all this stuff that's in chapter 1 about how messed up the minds of the world is. All of us victims of it. Huh? This isn't Christians going, all you people are all sinners. No, we all were. We all were, and we are unaccountably justified by the mercy of God. So, when Paul says, offer or present your bodies as a living sacrifice, your worship characterized by logos, Paul is proposing to us a worship imbued with what I'm calling mind's best quality, with logos. Another way of putting it, and it's a strong way of putting it, this is the worship of those who are in their right minds. Which, that's a good thing, to be in your right mind, as opposed to the upside-down world of people who exchanged natural relations for unnatural relations and the rest of the list that I'm embarrassed to read. Okay? Those are people, according to Paul, that are out of their minds. There's no logos in that kind of human activity. It's human beings, and they're not using what logos is for. So again, we can see in the formulation in Romans 12:1 that we have a tightly condensed version of these more extended developments earlier in the letter. And when the mind is set on the Spirit, the body's offered as a sacrifice can be a living sacrifice. For as Paul says in another verse, the Spirit is life and peace. We are able to offer worship characterized by logos because believers are no longer given over to a base mind, to an adokimon nun. That's not the way we're thinking. Our thinking has been set on the Spirit. And for this reason, we will not be surprised to see what Paul says in the next verse. And we can just slip into it, but I'm going to pull back from it after we slip into it. Your worship characterized by logos. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. Just the next sentence after logikos latreria. Do not be conformed to this world. That's why I spent all this time on chapter 1. You'd be crazy if you were conformed to this world. Instead, the renewal of your minds. And it's logos that will be the renewal of the mind. Now, what I've said so far about what this means, this phrase, logike latreria, is what can be said on the basis of the text of Romans itself. I haven't really left the text to explain this. I've referred to other parts of the text, other words in the text, and am making my argument based on that. But I want you to be aware that there's a whole other conversation and line of study that has been pursued around this question, that the same phrase, logike latreria, is part of Stoic philosophy, and it was very much in vogue in the Jewish diaspora, especially in Alexandria. In the Alexandria of a person who, if you know the great Jewish exegete and thinker, contemporary with Christ and Paul, of Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria, I once heard a lecture of a great patristic scholar on Philo of Alexandria, who introduced his lecture with the following sentence, very weightily delivered, an Oxford professor. And he said, Philo was an Alexandrian Jew. And we were supposed to know what that meant. What it means is a Jewish person imbued with Greek philosophy. And that movement was well underway in the diaspora, you know, Jews that were elsewhere in the world. And deep thinking was going on there. And that's the way I used to teach my students how to remember about the Jewish movement. I would give my little Jewish accent. Philo was an Alexandrian Jew. And one of the students came to his oral exam to me and told me, Philo was an Alexandrian Jew, he said, which meant he was Greek through and through. So I thought, well, I wish the professor had said that. Anyhow, okay, so... It's a very interesting line of study. I didn't go into it in my own study. I put kind of a long footnote there, which is quite interesting. But I want to draw some conclusions about what was happening in Greek philosophy in general, contemporary to Paul, including Jewish theology that was influenced by Greek philosophy. Paul would move very easily in all those worlds. The phrase, logike latreria, was out there saying, that's the kind of worship we want. killing all the animals is crazy. These are refined Jewish philosophers, and philosophy is not philosophy instead of religion in that world, that philosophy and religion are the same thing. But there's a very refined level of religion in Greek philosophy. So an ideal of worship was developed called worship characterized by logos. And Philo, or somebody like Philo, was following that line. There's a lot of talk about it in among Stoic philosophers. And basically, it's used in contrast to sort of gross slaying of animals and calling that worship. And instead, what worship is getting your mind right, getting your logos going big time, and getting it so logikos that you're not even bothered at all by your body anymore. You're not even in the body. You've become a mystic. Okay? So that's out there. I think Paul takes what's out there and does something absolutely shocking with it. He's worked the whole letter to get people straight in their bodies and to get the body alive with the life of Jesus' resurrection. If the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, then the Spirit will do in you what he did to Jesus, that is, give life to your mortal bodies. So the body's not going anywhere. The body's here, and there's life in my mortal body. It is Christ's new life in my body, and with my body, I can present myself to God. That is worship, and that's logike lateria. Forget the mysticism. That's Paul's point, I think. A very, very striking, I want to call it revolution. Very definitely, Paul is not for bloody sacrifice, but it has no meaning. But just as strongly, Paul would not be for pure interiority. And pure interiority were what the Stoics were arguing for, and what the Alexandrian Jews would have been arguing for. And Paul is not there. One final thought for tonight. Always on the word logos. The Greek ear hears the word logos in the adjective here, logike latreria. The Christian ear also hears, Christian ear and the Greek ear can be a same ear. So the Greek Christian ear also hears a title of Jesus Christ in the word logos. Not in Paul's writings, but Christian language is not discreetly divided into books and authors. So the title Logos for Christ is definitely in the Christian world. For this reason, the meaning of Paul's phrase grows through the centuries in which the text is pondered by the Christian community. I told you that my ultimate interest in the study that I'm sharing only in part with you was to see, first of all, what Paul says, and then to see how the community has understood what he says in subsequent centuries. Both of those are huge stories. We're still in the story of what Paul says. But I'm saying something right here now that we can't help but notice almost immediately, that because of the use of the word logikos here, and because it's a title for Christ, the Christian meditation on this verse immediately begins to associate the word logos with Christ and the worship that's possible. That becomes a very interesting story. I can tell you where it winds up centuries later, And tomorrow I'll try to say a little bit about some of the steps in between. But centuries later, what logike latreria will mean, or what worship characterized by logos will mean, is the divine logos's own worship of his Father. Jesus, the divine Son's, the logos's worship of his Father. And the worship offered by the Christian made possible by Christ the Logos. Now, it's impossible to say whether or not such Christological sense was part of Paul's reason for his choice of the word logikos, but the safest scholarship would be to say, no, you could never claim that. There's nothing in the text that lets you claim that, especially because this is the only place where Paul uses the word logos, and it's not directly referring to Christ. So it's just safer to say, no, Paul doesn't mean that. But in subsequent centuries, Christians will take it there, and they will conclude that the real logike latreria is in Jesus' sacrifice on the cross. And they will further connect logike latreria with the memorial of Jesus' death, namely the Eucharistic celebration, and that will also be called logike latreria. Here's where the scholarly conversation through the centuries begins to divide. It begins to divide on what this phrase means and what it refers to. It's not much difficulty reading Paul in and of himself the way we've done so far. But the question before us now will be, is it legitimate to take this phrase and extend it to an understanding of Christ's sacrifice on the cross and to an understanding of the church's Eucharistic celebration? It happened that the phrase was deeply and often applied there and consequently influenced the development of Eucharistic theology with this phrase, so that the celebration of the Eucharist was called, with many layers of understanding behind it, was called worship characterized by the Logos. Very complicated story, wonderful, fascinating, beautiful. But where I want to go next is not there where language went. I want to look tomorrow elsewhere in Paul's writing to see if such a development might be more legitimate than at first glance seems. I'm not going to claim that Paul meant to apply this to the Eucharist, but I am going to look at other verses with you that show Paul speaking about sacrifice and logikos and the mind and the bodies in such a way that we can see that it was not an unusual step for Christians who were celebrating Eucharist and reading the scriptures to use this language to understand what they were doing in the celebration of Eucharist. Okay? So that's our task for tomorrow. Good night. God bless you.